Welcome to the Ridley College podcast. Here you'll find public lectures, stories from our students and faculty, and insights from leading experts on the Bible, theology, and ministry.
Hi, I'm Rhys Bazant, Senior Lecturer in Church History at Ridley College. In this podcast, I have the honour to interview Dr. Rory Shiner from Providence Church in Perth, who's also our guest preacher at the upcoming Ridley Preachers Conference. We spoke here about the life of the preacher, the importance of preaching from the Old Testament, and we spoke as well about preaching from the book of Leviticus. Here's the interview. Rory, thank you so much, both for agreeing to come to our Ridley Preachers Conference, but also for making yourself available for this podcast. It's really wonderful to chat. We've known each other for a number of years, and it's always fun when we have conversations together. Perhaps you could introduce yourself, a little bit about your ministry in Perth, perhaps, your family situation.
Yeah, so Rory, and we're over here in Perth, which is where I'm from. So I was born in Albany, just 400 kilometres south of Perth, so I'm a West Australian, and after some wandering years, back home. And we're here with Susan. She is from the eastern side of Australia, so a Sydney cider that was extracted. She's from the Sutherland Shire, so it's a particularly insular part of Sydney. So I had to get a letter from the Shire Council to allow her to leave. Sure. So she's over here. We're over here. We've got four boys. They're all one's just finished high school. The rest are in secondary high school. And we're at a church called Providence Church. So I'm at Providence City Church. We've got a little network of three churches, so a bit of a church planting network, and that's where I've been for 10 years. So started there in 2014.
So there are three churches in the network. Did you plant the first of the network and then have gone on to plant others, or how's the network been arranged?
Yeah, so it's I am not the original planter. So the original Providence was planted in 2009 in a kind of missional house church model of church. So it was kind of on that Fresh Expressions house church innovative end of church planting, and they had some good years, and then probably a few years where that model kind of ran its course. So I came across in 2014. They had already planted the second church in the network by the time I got there. And I was involved in, not I wasn't the planter, but involved in recruiting and planting the third one. So that's how we've done it. So they're all churches. We've got a network and we share resources and so on, but they've all got a certain, high degree of independence as they do mission and ministry in their various parts of Perth.
And which part of Perth is your congregation? Is it in the northern suburb?
So we're in the inner north of of Perth. So we call ourselves Providence City Church. We meet in Subiaco in the evenings, which would be a familiar name if you know AFL, because it's where the big football oval used to be. And Subiaco in the evenings. We've got a morning congregation just a little bit north of that in a place called Lake Munga. And then there's a church in Bayswater, which is a kind of older suburb along the river, with a kind of inner city demographic vibe, and then Midland, which is out to the east.
Yeah, wonderful. Oh, terrific. You have a further qualification after your theological studies. You've done a doctorate. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so I did a doctorate essentially in Australian church history. When I left Western Australia and went to study on the East Coast, I just became really fascinated by the history of the way people have read the Bible in Australia. And I think in a way that probably isn't appreciated, there has been quite a distinctive contribution of Australian, especially biblical and New Testament scholarship. So people like Leon Morris and Broughton Knox and Graham Goldsworthy in the Old Testament and so on. Australia is a funny little country that's punched above its weight on that particular front. And I think with its kind of relative isolation has developed some interesting and occasionally quirky ways of approaching the text of Scripture. And one of the figures there is a guy called Donald Robinson. So my PhD was on what he's kind of contributed to that particular ecosystem.
And he kind of talked a lot about biblical theology, how the different strands of the Scriptures hold together, tell a grand story, right? And that was kind of what your doctorate was on?
Yeah, exactly. So he is the kind of he was the Archbishop of Sydney, so he's quite well known as an Anglican churchman, but less known in his biblical scholarship because he was the kind of the guy behind a generation that I better know. And so Graham Goldsworthy is often someone people know, and Graham was converted, if I can use that language, to biblical theology in a class where Graham put up his hand in the 1950s and asked a question in class. Because Donald had said something about how he thought the Bible held together. He said, oh, wait a minute, what did you say there? And Donald did a like 7-minute introduction to biblical theology, and that was Graham's, that was the starter pistol for his life's work.
Oh, how fascinating. I did not know that.
Yeah.
So he heard something in that lecture that was unfamiliar or was intriguing, so he was kind of triggered to ask further questions.
Yeah. I think generically a lot of us come to biblical theology because we haven't had a good model or any model of how the Old and New Testament relates. There are models out there, and I think the what Graham noticed is both that here was a way of relating the two testaments, and I think in Donald's case it was a very particular way. So there had been work done with Gerhardus Voss and others like that. And, you know, Brevard Childs and so on. But I think especially in that the place that Donald Robinson gave to the Kingdom of David and the idea that there was a promise and fulfillment in the Old Testament, that the promises to Abraham were fulfilled in David and Solomon, then there was the collapse and the exile. It just was, for Graham, it was just a much fuller account than he had come across before.
I think you're right. We don't appreciate in Australia how in some areas we punch above our weight. There's we make, but we're not aware of them or we take or something like that.
Yeah. I should also say, just given that I'm talking to you, you're in Melbourne, that Leon Morris also lived with the Robinson family when he came up to study in Sydney.
Morris was from Sydney originally, but it must have been after he was in Prince at Ridley that he returned and lived with the Robinsons or something.
No, let me think. He was, was he in Lithgow? And then he came, that's right, yeah. So he came across from Lithgow, knew the family from there because he'd gone to church with the Robinsons who were in Lithgow. And Leon Morris came and dazzled all the faculty at Sydney Uni and Moore College.
Yeah, sure. Oh, how neat. And you've recently taking some time off from ministry, your church graciously gave you a sabbatical.
Yeah, which is terrific. So I had 3 months off, and we went to the UK and Singapore, and mainly just kind of mucked about and relaxed with the family. But got to visit a few churches and did some study at a uni over there, and so that was also very stimulating. So I've kind of sort of come back with a full tank.
I think it was an Oxford University over there, right?
Yeah, so it was that Wycliffe Hall at Oxford, which is a great evangelical kind of theological hall within Oxford, and so that was terrific to be at a very well known university, but immediately find a group of people that love the same Lord Jesus.
And how great that your church would give you a sabbatical. It's so valuable, so not just for people in academic ministry, but otherwise to refresh, to meet new people, to think new thoughts, to see new things. I think it's just extraordinarily valuable. In fact, I came across a Harvard Business School report recently speaking of the value of sabbaticals for folk not in academic positions and how much it contributes to their long-term productivity, their long-term networking and engagement.
Yeah, look, I think if there's anyone on a board or a parish council or whatever, I think that's, especially as it fosters that kind of long-term ministry, which has particular advantages for local churches, just to be able to, I'll come back very refreshed. And one of the occupational hazards of being a pastor in a local church is you really do not visit other churches very much at all.
And yeah, in a,
And so it's hugely stimulating to see what else is going on out there. So, I'm very thankful.
Yeah, terrific. You preach most weeks at Providence, or how do you manage it as senior pastor?
Yeah, so I do. We try to keep it between about 60 and 70% of the preaching load is allocated to me. And so that, that's partly, I mean, I'm open to different configurations, but for me, that's a way of leading the church through preaching and teaching. There's other very competent preachers on our bench here, so I'm always glad to share the pulpit. But I do think that there is something about, I'm not the only person that can preach, but I'm the only person that can preach as the senior pastor, and that does have some significance, I think. Preach about 70% of the time, and then I try to make sure I'm around enough to hear the other preachers, both for my own edification. Like, I don't want to be someone who, never hears other people holding the word of God out to me. And I always love going to church and hearing other people preach. And I think also for the congregation, I wouldn't want to only not be preaching when I was on annual leave. I think that would I think the optics of that would just be also not helpful. Yeah,
sure. So it's not just that you're wanting to provide food, teaching through your sermons, but you're providing leadership for your sermons as well, which is really significant. I think it's often overlooked.
Yeah, I think it does. One of the things, I don't think the internet has changed this, but it's kind of clarified this for me, that I think I really want preaching to be a really analog experience, if I can put it like that, to say, because I think to myself, anyone could just, Google Tim Keller or Rhys Bazant or whatever, just find, great preaching out there, and they could tailor it to, they could probably Google feeling sad or happy or encouraged, or I need this, that, or the other. And you could curate a very bespoke kind of preaching ministry to yourself on your iPhone. But I think that preaching moment on a Sunday to a gathered congregation, the great thing about it, I think, is it can be really specific. It's this text and these people, and that combination will never happen again. That you'll never, that group of people will never again be gathered in quite that configuration to hear this text. And so I've noticed in my preaching more recently, I've been less and less generic and more stimulated by the thought that this is a moment that will never come again with a group of people that will, never gather on this day again. And I think I have found that that's actually given me a real energy for preaching, because otherwise you kind of beg the question, what are we doing here?
And you can have your AirPods in and listen to someone's sermon. They feel really intimate. They feel really close, but actually they don't love you. Yeah. They're on the other side of the world, whereas your pastor loves you and he knows you. And there's so much in that is valuable that we dismiss at great cost.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely. And I think it's a humbling group, because as you look out over a Sunday, I've been here 10 years, I've been here long enough that I know like a quarter of the people in the room I've had to apologize to or say, hey, sorry. So you're not preaching to a group of people that have a kind of curated, conference version you. They've got, the you that's kind of stumbled and all that kind of thing. It's a very powerful connection.
That's terrific, mate. And you've, in the last few years, is this right, preached a sermon series from the book of Leviticus?
Yeah, I'm trying to think if it was last year or the year before. I think it was last year, but we did do Leviticus and gave over. We tend to think in terms, like, or quarters, but school terms, and it was a whole term. So what's that, like 11, 12 weeks?
What brought you to the decision to preach from Leviticus? Like, there are very few pastors who allow themselves to be so indulgent, as it were.
Yeah, so it was a couple of things going on there. One was just a sheer, you put up the 66 books of the Bible on a screen and you realize that we hadn't done that and we'd, you know, been through the block two or three times on, say, 1 Corinthians or something and hadn't got to Leviticus. So that just kind of, that just spoke back to us saying there's maybe a missing part of our diet here. But I think as well the, you know, Leviticus, I think if you're a bit last minute with your planning, it'll always fall to the back of the ground because even if you're keen and think it's the word of God, you know, it kind of doubles or something your preparation time because it is that just that much more of a foreign a foreign land. Yeah. But we felt that I remember we paired it that year. We did Hebrews that year as well. And so took the opportunity to really lean into I think what would in academic circles would you call the cult. That's a bit of a confusing word in public, but the sacrificial system, the which is probably, I think, maybe the most foreign part of the Old Testament for us. And probably the most marginalized in the sense that I think in the last 50, 60 or even 100 years, probably in Old Testament scholarship, because there's so much in the prophets that has to do with kind of social justice and there's an energy and an immediate applicability about that as well as whereas the cult sort of the whole apparatus just sits there as like this is fulfilled and you know, how many times can you say fulfilled in Jesus, you know, the cross did it all.
The material is so foreign. Really love reading and thinking through Leviticus, but there are passages I get to and think, oh my word, I have no idea what's going on with that.
Yeah. And I do think that's, I reckon the, and I think what flipped it for us is, do we spend 7, 10, 12 weeks going to Leviticus and kind of making it like wearing sort of a Hazcam suit and saying, look, nothing to see here. This is all perfectly normal. Like this is our world. Yeah. And, or do you lean into the weirdness and say, hey, let's really sit this out and puzzle it out together. And that's the option that we went for, the second one. Because there is a logic there, but it's oblique. But it clearly, it makes sense to them that everything means something and there's a whole set of concentric circles and there are categories of things that are, that unclean but not immoral and you're moving constantly in and out and forward and backward. And so, yeah, rather than just say Old Testament, you know, that's how they dealt with sin, this is how we deal with sin, to go into the particulars, which I think actually was really enriching because I think that system, if you sit with it for a while and let its logic, its I guess symbolic logic bear down on you, I mean, it doesn't immediately, there's still parts there that are very puzzling to me, certainly wouldn't claim to have cracked it all, but if you sit with it long enough, I think the way the symbolic universe works, it gives you actually a richer account of, I guess, the consequences of the fall and the nature of not only guilt but shame and kind of social alienation and so on. Like it just is a more complex take on what it means to live in a broken world, which I think actually we live in a complex situation. So to sit with the complexities of what sin and guilt do to us was actually, I think it was actually really good for us as a church.
Yeah. And to live in someone else's world for a while, it might feel strange. The rules, the worldview, the default settings are all so different from ours, but that actually makes us spiritually nimble and makes us aware of where our world differs from the assumption.
Yeah.
So I think that's good for us. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think that's a brilliant point. And that, I think that is, I think one of the kind of macro problems we face is that, say, in Western culture, you kind of think, oh, because Christianity's been kicking around here for, you know, 1,500 years and feels like there's maybe a home ground advantage. But when you go to somewhere like Leviticus, if you're in a multicultural congregation, literally every person is aware that you're stepping into a world that is no one's, apart from maybe any Jewish background people in the congregation, that you're not saying to the Chinese background person or the Arabic background person, come into my world. You're all putting it in your backpack and going together in a world that's no one's. Yeah.
Well, that's a great thing. I thought you were going to say, and there are some cultures where still there are assumptions about sacrifices and about offerings and so on. You went in a slightly different direction, but there was even...
Well, that's also true, that you go, absolutely, that you go to somewhere like Leviticus and parts that maybe are more difficult if you're from a Western background, resonate with people who understand the dynamics of corporate shame and so on more. And yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I know when I preach from 1 Corinthians, Chinese folk in the congregation have always said to me afterwards, we struggle with this idea of offering sacrifices to ancestors and so on. What do we do? And does 1 Corinthians kind of 9, 10, 11 help us think about these kinds of things? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
In preaching from Leviticus in Providence, was there a text or a sermon that was particularly hard or particularly encouraging moments in the series?
Yeah, I think it's Leviticus, you have the Day of Atonement in chapter 16, I hope I got that right, which kind of, there is a kind of chiastic structure, which is a, you know, like the, if you think of the letter X, that sits in the middle. And I think that's quite deliberate in the way the materials arrange, that you're moving in toward that center. So I think there is a natural center of gravity in the book of Leviticus at the physical center of the book. Mm-hmm. And I'm just trying to think if this is true. I think this is right. I can check it on the website. I think we did preach it chiastically. That is, we preach the outside chapters, like on either side, and then moved into the center. So I think the last sermon was on the Day of Atonement, which had a bit of a crescendo effect. So,
what a brilliant way of thinking of it. I wouldn't have thought to do that. And it's probably not the way you'd encourage most books of the Bible to be preached, but I can see how it works.
There was a bit of a fashion probably about 10 years ago where people went chiasm crazy and they were seeing it everywhere. And but I think in Leviticus that is quite a clear structure. And then often in a book like Leviticus, in a preaching program, it can feel like it peters out at the end, because you'll often find that in the TNIV, it'll say something like miscellaneous laws or whatever, because you can see the whoever's writing the titles has thought, I don't really know what's going on here. But working out that Day of Atonement, I think at a literary level, it is at the center. But even if it wasn't, I think at in terms of the logic of the cult, almost all of it kind of pushes toward that day as this kind of, I think we talked about that day in the series as the, have you tried switching it off and on again thing? Because it's almost as if the whole atonement system is, if you think of it like a computer, you're doing all these things throughout the year to manage cleanness and uncleanness, guilt and shame and so on. But the Day of Atonement is just, let's just restart the whole thing.
Reboot. Yes, I see. Yeah. I see. Oh, how fascinating. Brother, you're preaching for us at our Preachers Conference, April 23 and 24, three sermons on Leviticus. Katie Davies is also speaking for us on the book of Leviticus as well, some themes, given that she's writing a commentary on Leviticus at the moment. We're so thankful to you that you can be with us. You're preaching three sermons, I think.
Yeah.
And we're really looking forward to having you with us.
Great. Can't wait.
Thank you so much, both for making yourself available this morning and also for coming to Ridley for our annual Preachers Conference. Thanks,
Rory. No worries. Really looking forward to it.
The annual Ridley Preachers Conference is on April 23 to 24. If you wish to join us, the registration link is in the show notes, or visit ridley.edu.au for more information.
Thank you for listening to the Ridley College podcast, brought to you by Ridley College. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing and liking our podcast. Also, be sure to check out our Ridley Chapel Sermons podcast through the link in our podcast description. This podcast is made possible through the generous donations of our alumni and supporters. We welcome your partnership with us in our mission of equipping men and women for God's mission in a rapidly changing and increasingly complex world. If you'd like to contribute to our work, you can donate via the link in the description below.